This is the Amp Hour Podcast, released July 26th, 2020, episode 502, Lowest Common Denominator Design.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
What's up, nerd?
Hey, man. You're going to change the blog name to EEV Drive or EV something? I don't know.
EV something. Oh, I can. I might do a teaser Twitter photo. Anyway, I'll tell you about that. No, I'll just tweet it. Doesn't matter. Anyway, okay. So you want to talk about that straight off the bat, do you?
Sure. Well, we can talk about other stuff. We'll leave that as a teaser for later too. Yeah. What's going on in your design world? What are you building these days?
What am I building? I am working on. You saw a video. I'm working on selecting chips at the moment and working on a potentially different variant of the microcurrent.
So it's almost like maintaining. You're like the maintaining engineer as well. You're
the component obsolescence engineer, and right.
The CEO, the maintaining engineer, the janitor, the marketing person. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh man.
Oh boy. And I did a video looking at, because I designed the microcurrent 12, 13 years ago or something. Like, it's a long time ago. It's actually before the blog, right? Mm-hmm. And back when I was a regular engineer. When I actually had a real day job.
Instead of playing one on TV, you're saying?
Right, yeah, instead of playing one on TV, yeah. And the things haven't changed. Like, I pretty much came to the conclusion that the Maxim chip I chose back then is still pretty much the duck's guts.
Well, Maxim has changed.
Oh, yes. Didn't Maxim? Yeah, they got...
Swallowed up by Analog Devices. Yeah.
Oh, well, has it actually happened? Or they said they were going to?
It has officially been announced, during the quiet period now. But okay. Yeah, so Analog Devices is buying Maxim for
$20 billion. $20
billion. And of course, I went on Twitter and complained about it, and everyone's like, well, but it's small compared to other things. I don't care about other, you're gonna compare it to Samsung, you're gonna compare it to Intel. I don't care about those companies. I care about the ones that I'm buying from.
Right. Yeah.
And I care about less part choice, and I care about the fact that there's going to be fewer support people and fewer people in the industry. And it's like, this is a bad thing. I mean, I always keep maintaining that. Even the LT stuff, like, we've already seen.
Oh yeah. Exactly.
You know, there's been layoffs from Linear Technology.
Linear Technology in turn gobbled up a couple of others. And then, didn't they over the years? Burr Brown? Who bought Burr Brown?
Or was TI. That's TI.
Oh, TI. Okay, yes, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, when it comes down to it, I figure there's going to be two left standing. You know, Pepsi and Coke is going to be TI and Analog Devices. You know, I think that's how it's all shaken out right now. And there's going to be other type of chip suppliers, and that's fine. You know, there will be other ones out there, but I don't know, the ones that I pick from.
for my entire career, like, Maxim and Analog Devices have been like arch rivals, you know.
Sure,
it's been, you know, like, you're a Maxim man. And Maxim always, for those who don't know, back in the old days, it's changed these days, but Maxim always came out with, they were just churning out new designs like there was no tomorrow. They would actually release these 6-monthly data books, 2 inches thick data books with new chips they'd just released in the last 6 months. It was just so you got these like 6.5 yearly.
You get the update book.
Data books,
you
get the update books, because they couldn't print one data book big enough back when we had data books that actually contained all of the chips that they produce. So you had to get the yearly books.
Gather on, children. The olds are talking about data books.
Yeah, that's it. And but that was the thing. And they came out with so many, and their lead times were so horrendous, at which we got a segue for lead times. So let's remember that for microchip. And and you couldn't get these things. You know, Maxim had the best sample service in the business, right? You could get samples, so you can get onesies, twosies. And that was great for when I was working at the various military companies, right, we would only make like a handful of things, right?
Yeah, so, things, yeah.
Yeah, so using the Maxim parts was great because you only needed a couple of chips because we'd only build like five boards. So we'd get out like five sample chips and then bingo, yep, that's yep, our entire production run done.
Yeah, I have a data point against that right now because I just got some parts in the mail yesterday and, you know, they're obviously very different chips. They're more complex, but I got some cellular modems that are like, you know, sub $10 in production, but they charge more. They actually charge for the samples. There is no sampling from QuickTel. Of course, but you're right.
Okay, yeah.
And then it's like, so it was like $75 for five modems and then another $75 to ship them here because they only do international courier. And right, so it's like, oh my God, yeah. You know, I don't expect them to do, you know, sampling, but still, these are $30 modems now. Like, this is not, this is,
right,
you know, comparing to a sample program, you know, like this is the opposite. This is the new reality. It's like, no, you're paying for everything. Okay, fine, you know.
Yeah, it's different.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Do many companies, many companies offer sample services anymore? Is it a thing? I haven't got.
So TI has like a official sample one. I think they have like online registration things. Yeah, they'll send you like, you know, two or three parts. And then past that, then you got to start talking to salespeople and, you know, getting in the ERP system and proving that you're
legit, right,
you know.
The old question, you know, what's your estimated yearly buy?
EAU's all they care about. That's right. Right.
Yep. And of course, everyone fudged that. But back in the day, like Maxim, nobody beat Maxim for samples. It was absolutely brilliant. It was free. They didn't care who you were. And they would just, you know, send them to you, you know, and you'd get them by it via courier or whatever. And it was just crazy good. But you couldn't get them because the chips were like 40 weeks lead time.
They were sampling to anyone, but then they were selling to the big boys. And yeah, we've talked about that many times. Really, this is the only thing I'm sad about is that we won't have like, you know, fun things to, you know, kick around with Maxim having, oh, we're different this time. You know, no. Right. We're getting better with our, you know, supply. And it's like, okay, well, I guess that's gone now. And I'm sure, you know, ADI is pretty great about their supply and I'm sure it'll be fine, but.
Oh, no, it's good. And Analog Devices, like the two companies at Maxim were kind of like the company that made the cool, novel, new chips. They were always churning out, but
weird chip kind of thing.
One-off weird kind of things, you know. So if you had a niche, you know, a product that did this thing, Maxim probably made some analog-y type chip that, you know, did that. Whereas Analog Devices made you, if you really needed like really high precision, you know, the best characterized, you know, the best parts, you know, possible in terms of performance, you went to Analog Devices. You know, Maxim wouldn't have been your first choice. So, yeah, but now they're one. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of feels like that, doesn't it? It's like, it's how do you vanquish your foe? Well, you buy him. Okay.
And the crossover on their parts must be enormous.
That will be
so imagine
too.
The team they've got. Now, just, you know, they're probably, if they don't have a team already, they're forming it, figuring out which parts to actually discontinue. Yeah.
Who's the winner and who's the loser?
Yeah, although exactly.
I would imagine that, like, I think they're all, I think, well, I remember ADI was, you know, they outsourced their, you know, fabrication as well. And, you know, everybody's using like TSMC or similar foundry type works.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of like carrying costs for like the actual parts on hand, I have to imagine that it would make more, you know, like there probably isn't drop-in replacements. Just because they don't really do that. I mean, or if there are, then, you know, maybe there's a subset of the, you know, the functional crossovers that they'll be like, no, well, actually out of the 30% crossover that we see here, 5% are pin compatible, function compatible. You have to switch over now. But I imagine that most of them, the amount they would be pissing off customers would not be worth it.
Oh, yeah, no, it'd be enormous. No, you wouldn't expect them to suddenly discontinue them. I mean, these companies never suddenly discontinue chips. They always give you a warning, like this is like now an obsolete component, last buys are coming in 2 years' time. You know, look, just plan your, you know, these companies are good at that sort of thing. So. Yeah. But yeah, there's got to be a huge amount of crossover there where, you know, as you said, pin compatible parts. But yeah, maybe, you know, 5-10%, something like that I'd expect.
In all this, every time this happens, right, this just happened with LT, and it really bugs me because, okay, some people might say, well, it's more efficient, you know, fine, there's, you know, fewer people in the marketplace, fewer places you have to shop. It's like, okay, but there, that means there's fewer options. There's few people like fewer people innovating and trying to offer parts to different segments of the market. And I just think there's less competition's worse in this scenario. So,
Totally.
I don't think prices are going to go down. I don't think, I don't think there's really any benefit for us. I think it's really just a shareholdery kind of thing. And then they're like, okay, great. They're a bigger company now. They can, squeeze their margins harder and they make more money for their shareholders. Okay, fine. But that doesn't help me as a user.
Exactly.
But we don't really have any choice either. So even though Tim Ansel was on the show last week, he was talking about the open source PDK.
Yep.
And, we talked about some of the analog stuff. It's like, it's not like that's coming up anytime soon. That's not going to be offering op amps,
no, exactly.
Precision op amps for anyone anytime soon, or precision ADCs. It might be highly integrated and have have some analog capabilities in it, but it's not going to be anything like that. And so, if you're precision, you're basically, you're shopping in, column A or column B and take what you got,
For those who don't know, when you're fabbing chips like that, unlike your digital chips, which you can just test and that's it, you can easily exercise the chips out, maybe if they're really ultra high speed, high performance, that kind of thing, there's sort of variations. But analog chips are different. Analog chips, you have to characterize and guarantee various performance limits. If you deep dive down into the data sheets,
you got to look at them bins.
You got to look at the binnings, and they sell all the different grades of op amps for a reason. It's because they've got to individually bin them, and voltage references and stuff like that. They'll be binned into five different grades of actual parts depending on how they come off the production line and how they're tested. And it's really complex and expensive to not only design test jigs to characterize all this analog performance, but actually do that as well. So if you think that you can
do it on every wafer, every segment of every wafer, it's not like you can do some sampling thing. You got to be like, unless it's like some super low cost thing, which they're probably not doing anyways.
Right. So that's what we're saying. Even if they do have this, do it yourself analog fab ASIC thing, then not be as good as it sounds. So you may be better off.
Yeah, I think it'd be good only in the integration piece. That's really the only thing I can imagine. And everything else that you need on, so like Tim was talking about too, it's not just pure analog, high precision analog type stuff. It's more like, there's other analog things on board. He said like the IO section is analog, everything that's not running actual just logic elements has some analog component to it. And you have to plan for that.
Maybe you'd be better off like going for some custom hybrid bare die solution, for example, like take the existing, if you want a complex analog system, take existing off-the-shelf wafers that are all characterized and tested and actually assemble those on like a hybrid module or something like that yourself, rather than actually design and build your own, high-performance analog ASIC.
Yeah.
Jeez, Yep.
Yeah. And that's kind of like what Ming was talking about a couple weeks ago too, from Zigloo. I don't remember if we said they did any analog stuff though. I guess some of the chips that they pulled in were, they had sensors, but I think all the interconnect between them. So that was like the chiplets and the chiplets go down onto like a substrate and then you can talk between the different chips.
Yeah. Right.
But I'm not sure if that, I do like the chiplet idea though. I think that is a very interesting idea, but again, it's going to be TI or ADI.
It's niche. It's not.
You're only going to have so many choices there. So, and then however many of the parts that are out in the system that are actually capable or available as chiplets as well.
Yep.
Doesn't really matter for me. I don't think I'm ever going to get a bit of volume to be able to do that unless it gets so low that it's, literally as simple as making a PCB, but I don't think we're there for a couple years at least.
Right. Well, who makes the analog FPGA type things? Those EPAC ones, the electrically programmable.
Analogic is sticking out of my mind, but I don't know if that's
Analogic. No, it's one of the other mainstream. I can't believe.
That's
can't
a healthcare
remember.
Company.
Now we're frantically trying to find it in the.
Well, I mean, it's not really a. It's Cypress has the PSoC.
The PSoC. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, Cypress with their PSoC.
Yeah, like PSoC is kind of reconfigurable. Man, those are really expensive. Like,
yeah, they're not cheap, but they're kind of cool.
Very cool. Yeah.
But as is common with a lot of these modular analog things, they're not that high performance.
Exactly. Yeah. If you need like 16-bit, 24-bit, you're not going to probably get that in there. I think I've seen 12-bit
And even then, the specs are a bit loosey-goosey, yeah. I think. Yeah. Please correct. I'm sure.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. At the end of the day, I'd prefer to mix and match. I don't want, like I think that the answer for having analog at, you know, in the open PDK thing, it's like, yeah, some people are going to want integrated analog. Okay, great. But yep. I don't think that's the answer for me because I'm not making custom chips either. You know, like I'm going to be mixing and matching for as long as they're available. It's just that I don't like that there's fewer available now.
Oh, well.
I've belabored this point enough, I think. Let's talk about sourcing stuff. so this was someone actually wrote in. Oh, shoot. I forgot who wrote in. We'll get his email up here. But there's actually an email. So we were talking about like lead times from Maxim, right? Like 44 weeks. But apparently Microchip sent out an email, a letter to all their customers. They're like, hey, guys, what you're doing is not cool. That's kind of how it read to me.
Exactly.
I don't know.
How dare you order parts from us?
Right.
That's not cool.
Right.
Sorry. We have to explain this because that sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. So, this is from David. So David wrote in. Thank you, David. And basically the letter says, we're getting all these orders. We don't know where they come from, but people are asking for expedited orders. And expedited always is kind of weird to me in general too. Like, so one of my buddies who's a buyer, he's like, yeah, you know, we could do expedite. I'm like, it's kind of like,
why is it standard?
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, well, it's like it's like sending an email with urgent on it. You know, eventually there's inflation and everything gets marked as urgent or double urgent or triple urgent or must read now, you know, like, and it's just, it becomes meaningless. And so like, that's a thing that you can do when you contact these fabs. And you can try and get a hot lot, or you can try and get expedited, jump the line, whatever. And so this letter saying like, hey, we're getting this a lot right now. They don't know what it's from, and we can make conjecture on that, I'm sure.
Well, they actually speculate what it is.
Yeah,
they speculate that all companies were shut down. Yeah, companies right. were shut down. All of a sudden, they've come back into business because the companies were shut down due to lockdowns, and now they're back in business. And all of a sudden, everyone wants their stuff. And they have to ramp back up, and bingo, they want their chips now, please. Mm. And basically, they're saying, sorry, our normal product lead time is 16 to 20 weeks. And they're saying, can you please at least give us 12 weeks of backlog visibility? Like, please? It's like, we can't just bump every, you know, we can't expedite everyone's order. It's just not possible. Like, if you get a PCB manufacturer, which is like a short, you know, like chips have a very long lead time, right? There's lots of process steps involved. But, you know, a PCB can be turned around in like a day or, you know, hours, right? Yeah. And you can pay to have your design expedited. But it literally means they put you to the front of the queue, they bump everyone else's job, and then they immediately start working on your board. We used to do this when we were at Audi, and we would have like 8 to 10 layer boards turned around in 24 hours,
yes. right?
24, that's not cheap. And it'd be thousands of dollars for for a prototype board. But we wanted it for various reasons, and they would expedite it, and they would bump everyone else's job, and they would manufacture our board, and they would literally start 10 minutes after you send in the email saying, yep, we're happy to pay that expedited price. Then somebody, boom, immediately starts working on it, bumps every other job, you know, and and you get in there. But chips, it's a bit more complicated.
The thing is, when you're starting from sand, I mean, I think the stuff that I used to work on in the fab, it was like a 30-day start to finish, you know, wafer in, wafer out kind of thing. And that's like getting, I think that was even just a test. And then you're a test then at 30 days. So let's call that 4 weeks. You've got, you know, all the lead times and shipping and everything else. And then you have to ship it to another country to usually get packaged up. And then there's further testing past that, and then shipping out to a distributor or shipping out to directly to your manufacturer. And it's like, I mean, 6 weeks is
there's a huge process flow there. It's
And not to mention, like, if they're ordering material, like say there was a huge surge. I mean, I always think about it kind of like traffic too, you know, like when like a traffic jam is like starting back up, there's always like the start, stop, just to try and like even out the flow. And it's like, if basically, you know, if you get to the point where you now want to start speeding, that being like a very fast lead time, well, you're stuck behind everything else, and then it all ripples through the system as well. Like, if you want, even if you wanted, so say you got your absolute minimum down to 6 weeks, okay, great. well, what about the wafers? You know, like if the wafers aren't in the system too and shipping to the fab, then they're, you know, it's just, you can't like conjure it out of thin air because it's, you have to start somewhere. So yeah, it's, there's some very, very tough realities, especially when you're talking about the volumes that, you know, some people are like, well, you know, I could see on DigiKey there's, or Mauser, there's, you know, 10,000 parts. It's like, okay, what if you need a million?
Yeah, exactly.
You're not buying a million parts off distribution unless it's capacitors. And even then, not really.
Lead times, pain in the ass.
Interestingly, on the subreddit page for this, Maddie guy said, same old song and dance, a variation of this letter has been on Microchip's homepage since I entered the industry. Nothing to see here.
Oh, really? Okay.
Interesting. Right. Oh yeah, I've never seen it before, but I'm not on the homepage of Microchip very often. So,
no, I haven't used, yeah.
And then DR Twist said, as Microchip customers, we don't have any kind of visibility into our own customer short-term demand. And that's, again, that's like the traffic thing.
Ah,
like,
right, yes, of course.
You know, like as you know, everybody gets stopped up at certain points. And yeah that whole, the whole COVID thing, basically, I mean, everyone, I think the market crash really did it at the beginning. Everyone like clammed up. They're like, we're not spending any cash. And now, we got tons of cash. We'll spend as much as we can. And, so, and then there's nothing there because everybody shut down, you know? So,
it's nuts. The world is nuts.
Economics. It's silly.
Anyway, but there's like, as they said, there's nothing new here at all. I mean, this, you know, chip backlogs of people take for granted. Like, you know, most people who are probably listening to this show are sort of like your more low volume type stuff. You used to be able to get in stuff X stock from DigiKey and Mouser and Element 14 and all those sort of places, right? But when you're talking about volume production, it's an entirely different game. It really is, you know?
That's the first thing. So like whenever I have a new client and they're like, okay, we think we're going to make, I don't know, 50,000. And I you know, I show them the math. I go, okay, you want 50,000 units next year. I have to put, let's say 50 LEDs on this one project. You know, it was like an LED project. Mm.
Yeah.
50 LEDs times 50,000 boards.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you can't get that many LEDs in many places, especially if they're special at all. So like, just so you know, there is going to be a very specific lead time. It's at least 20 weeks. So like, build that into everything you do.
And you have to make those design decisions up front, and you have to buy those, you know, and then you're stuck with that part. It's like, no, we can't change that part now because we've already ordered, you know, 500,000 parts.
Yeah, better
it's
make like, sure you did stuck. Your math right.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes.
That's fun.
Because you can get caught out. Like, you know, like if you didn't do your engineering properly, if you didn't do it thorough enough, you go, oh God, no, this chip is just like, it looked great on the surface. It worked great on the prototype, but we didn't do the thorough, you know, thermal testing or whatever. And we thought, oh no, it's not the right part. No, we're going to have to get this other one. It's like, you know, you've just blown, you know, 500,000 parts, right?
Yep.
It's just, yeah, it's nuts. Engineering, it's hard.
It's fun.
Hardware's
hard. I don't know. I had this thought the other day. Like, I've been doing a lot of CAD lately, and like, like I kind of like look up, and I'm like, you know, I'm kind of like in the flow, and like, but like some of this stuff, man, it's great. It's really great. Like learning new things too. I think I said that last time. Yeah.
Nerd.
I like learning. I know, right?
Yeah, total nerd. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Some of us read books, Dave.
Right.
I actually have been reading. There was an RF. You know, I do it before I fall asleep usually, and this was a bad choice for at night because I was like already thinking about work stuff, and then I couldn't sleep. And I was like, "Oh, I'll read a book about layout. This is a great idea." Nope, bad idea. But there's a. I think I mentioned it before. There's like an RF layout book. It was just like an Amazon book. It was from a consulting company, and they're like, "Yeah, we'll just publish a book here."
Right.
So it's kind of good. I've been dealing a lot with like RF spacing and stack ups and all that kind of stuff lately. And it's been interesting. It's, you know, a little challenging. I don't know how much, have you done that a lot or no?
Oh, well, this is a video I'm going to edit after this, actually. And this comes up on the forum because somebody on the forum, they're developing this little board. It's got like an image sensor. It's got an FPGA on it, like a small FPGA. So a low-end image sensor, like, you know, 640 by 480 or whatever. And a low-end FPGA is just like a quad flap. It's a, you know, a 32-pin FPGA. It's nothing.
Oh yeah, that's tiny. Yeah.
And yeah, and so they asked for feedback on the, so they wanted to know about layer, they first started asking about layer stack up and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Oh, which stack up? Because I'm using a four layer board because I've got to route out this little pain in the ass BGA image sensor package. So I need the trace. And that's an interesting trade-off. Normally you could have laid out this board on a two layer board, but because the pin pitch and the image sensor BGA was, it's designed for like use in mobile phones. And by the looks of it, this image sensor, the pin pitch is so small that you can't route out, you know, the traces have to be 5 thou or less to route these things out, right? So the two layer process manufacturing tolerances didn't allow for traces that small that he wanted to use the particular service. So he was sort of like forced into the four layer service so that he could get better tolerance on the track and space. So he's got the luxury of a four layer board now, and he wanted to know how to stack it up and stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, but he's, so I'm guessing he's using JLC, right? I can tell that.
Yeah,
just from
he's, he's using JLC.
Yeah, because it's five on two layer and 3.5 on four layer. Okay,
right,
fine.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. So he, so he's forced in the, so, you know, you've got luxury of the four layer.
You can't do the stack up then. You're not you're talking about the layer stack or the
I'm talking
like,
about the layer stack. Yeah. Yeah, no, he just wanted to know like which one should be ground, which one should be signal, which one should be power and stuff like that. So started off asking about that and then got into, you know, talking about bypass capacitors. And then somebody on the forum who's like a really high-end RF designer, you know, jumped in and like sort of went to town about this is how you have to, you know, you've got to have a bypass capacitor for every via that you have on your board because, you know, so he was thinking in RF terms. You know, which is which is all valid, you know, really valid, great advice for RF, RF design, but he's got that RF thinking. So, you know, so that's how it came. So that's how he was answering the question from the RF perspective. If I'm going, hang on a sec, this is a low-end FPGA, like bypass is not going to matter a rat's. You could have one bypass cap for this whole thing. It's not going to matter a rat's ass. Yeah. You know, it's like because it's so low-end.
You said like RF, you know, like RF thinking or like high, you know, digital speed thinking or analog thinking. All of these are like approximations, right? These are all like or abstractions rather of like these design rules that are like kind of internalized. And yeah, I mean, when you try and apply one to the other, it doesn't always make sense from a cost perspective or a density perspective. But then again, like you look at like, I just bought an RF amplifier the other day and I was talking to someone on Twitter who had cracked theirs open and like, it's really simple inside because it kind of has to be, you know, like it's like, and like a lot of RF circuits are, you know, not simple overall. Like they're very complex, I think, but you know, in terms of like the density you can have and just the design, you know, how you think about the design around it, that also drives some of these design rules that you might, you know, not design rules. That's a bad, probably bad disambiguation of the term, but like these kind of design methodologies around it, because you might go and optimize for something that's not usually really dense, and now you take it to a really dense process like a four layer BGA type thing, and it's like, oh, okay, well, this isn't going to work now.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that just the you can actually over engineer things, like, or you can go into all the detailed engineering for bypass capacitors and everything else when you don't need to. It's like, so, and when it comes to PCB layout, I guess there's no such thing as over-engineering a PCB layout because it's just a little bit of time. Like there's nothing, like it's not adding really any extra cost.
You don't pay per ounce of copper.
Yeah, right.
Unless,
so,
unless you make everything thicker,
Right. So if, you know, if you like do all your ground planes and you do massive via stitching and all sorts of other you know, techniques, and you might do star grounding when you don't need to, you know, and all that sort of jazz. It's, you know, so there's nothing wrong with using, you know, good engineering rules of thumb on PCB layouts when you don't need to, because there's no real, you know, so you can over engineer a PCB and it doesn't cost you much. But when you over engineer like bypass capacitors, they're expensive. You know, if you get like your one mic and your 10 mic bypass capacitors, you can't put like, you know, 100 of those on a board. Jeez, you watch your BOM cost soar, right? Those little, especially the smaller they get, the more expensive they get.
I need a 10 microfarad C0G.
Yeah.
$10,000, sir.
Can you even get a 10 microfarad
COG? I don't think
COG?
So. No.
I don't think you can. Yeah, no. Think, yeah. Back when I was doing COG work, like, I think 10 nanofarads was enormous.
Yeah.
Like we were paying like $10 per capacitor or something. And it's like, and there's only one manufacturer in the world that does it. Like yeah. it was, yeah. you know.
Why would you need it for the tolerance or something or what?
No, it was for the analog performance. It was for the, because these were AC coupling capacitors and sampling capacitors in a ultra high end 24-bit analog to digital converter.
Right. But for super slow signals, so you need a high capacitance.
You need high linearity. You need, yeah. you know, everything else. You can't have it, you know. So yeah, you know, it was nothing to pay $10 for a capacitor.
You weren't using, were you using the capacitor, those C0G as decoupling? Or are you using those in, you said?
Oh, no. AC. These are in the signal path. No, these are sampling capacitors for your, your converters and their, you know, coupling capacitors and, you know, coupling, wow. not decoupling. Right, as in right. there, right? So, and so the quality, sampling capacitors are, for example, really critical that you have a very low drift. You know, mm-hmm. ultra stable cap yep, as your sampling yep. capacitor. So,
If it changes halfway through a cycle, you start to lose frequency information, right?
Yeah. So, yes, exactly. And they're non-linear with temperature and voltage and all sorts of horrible, you know, things which you don't care about for a bypass capacitor. But when you're, when you're actually processing a signal, especially at 24 bits, it's a real big deal. And that's why mm-hmm. even if you open up like a simple multimeter, right, for example, if there's a sampling capacitor, because it's got dual slope integration, so there'll, you know, often be a sampling capacitor in there, they will have even like a special through hole cap. They will have like everything yeah. else's service mount on there, and they'll have the one through hole part, which is a poly put the kettle on type material, right? Because that's your sampling capacitor. It's actually critical. It has to be a proper type. You can't just whack in a bloody, you know, a Y5U ceramic, you know. Oh god.
Right, right. It's I found this horrid. On the carpet in the engineering lab.
Yeah, exactly. Whack that in and oh god. Yeah. Anyway, yes, special capacitors. Oh goodness, there's a whole art and science there.
So I thought you were going to be talking about the actual stack up of the board. We talked about that.
Oh yes, sorry. Yeah, I got sidetracked on the board. Yes, we were talking about the stack up of the board and things like that, and how, you know, look, the signal layers are going to go on top and bottom. You're going to put your power grounds in the middle. Most SMD layouts, the holy grail of SMD layout is to get all your signal traces on the top layer, right? And because your components are on the top, you lay it out as if it's a single-sided board, right? It's almost going like back 40 years, old school, where, you know, everything was single-sided, none of this double-sided rubbish. Right. So SMD designs, you think when you're laying it out, you need to be in the mindset, right, this is a single sided layout. So I want all of my, you do as many traces as you can on the top layer. And then then you route your power traces and things later, because you can't go running power traces along the top layer, because that's where you want to run your signal wires, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what this design did. It was like running one power trace from one side of the board to the other on the top layer. And it's like, oh, then you've got no room to route your signal traces. So like 10 vias down for all the signal traces just to sacrifice. So you sacrifice 10 signal traces for one power trace. It's like backwards. So anyway, it's hard to talk about. You have to visualize.
Well, you're going to make a video about it.
So I'm going to make a video about it. So it's just fascinating.
You know, it's interesting.
Stuff.
So I have two things about. So I'm using JLC for the board I'm doing contextual electronics.
Yep.
One thing that's really really interesting about it is looking at the controlled impedance calculator. I can't get any other calculator to match what their calculator and their actual like board stack up is.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so what I'm guessing is that they have some empirical values that they just plugged in there.
Yeah, probably. Yes, that's likely, very likely.
And it, like, you know, and given that, it's probably a good idea to just follow what they say and then, you know, ask them why it didn't work. And but it's still kind of like, it's, you know, I don't really like that. I like to rather have it spec'd out. And so still going back and forth on that.
Yep.
I also made the choice about the 3.5 millimeter thing. And what I've been trying to do is I'm using a NRF
53 3.5 millimeter.
Sorry, 3.5 mil. Thank you.
Mil, thous.
Or thou, yeah. 0.0889 millimeter trace in space.
Oh, and, come on.
What?
Give it to me in imperial. Track and space is always imperial.
3.5 mil or thou, yeah.
Oh, so it's 2.5
3.5. Sorry. Space Trace.
Space Trace. Okay.
Yeah. And so this part that I'm using, it's got this really ugly, like it's called an AQFN, but what it is like a dual row, like tiny VGA with a huge thermal pad in the middle. And the part is great, but like to escape that, like basically they show, okay, you either got to do like blind and buried vias, and that's, that's like the suggested layout is, and that's what I've done in the past. But that basically takes the board cost up a ton. Well, someone pointed me to Luke Valenti's post for Tiny FPGA. Have you seen those boards before?
I've heard about them.
Heard about him. Okay, yeah. So he does like super fine pitch stuff, and I'll share a link to it. But it's he bastardizes the outside pins, and then he makes them pill shaped, and he did a bunch of testing on it. But basically, because of the surface tension of the BGA, he's able to basically neck down the outer pins to this pill shape,
right,
and then escape using a larger space trace than he would have otherwise. And he tested it on multiple boards.
And it worked.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's fine, but like.
So he's got the circular pads on the inner ring, and then the outer ring, he necks them down. So they're
he's actually doing a BGA. So it's multiple rows. I think it's a 6x6.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
But that is the outer row is the important one.
Don't gain any actual space by making them elongated, because like a BGA pad is circular, so how do you neck it?
Well, no. So he took it, he basically said, hey, here's the surface area of the original circle, and then he made the pill shape to be an equivalent amount, assuming that the surface tension of, or sorry, the ball size will stretch itself out.
Okay.
So it's not more overall space, not overall more surface tension or surface area rather.
Yeah, right. Gotcha.
But it's just a different shape then. And then you can escape through those pins.
So the elongated pad, the neck down pad, is actually a smaller width than the original circular pad.
Smaller. Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yep, that's right.
It has to be. Yeah. Yeah, it has to be. So, okay. Well, everyone's like starting to twitch now. Anyone who knows anything about this sort of stuff is really starting to.
Well, like I said, he tested it, and so it's interesting. I don't know if he went for that. I think it was just for a prototype. And so, anyways, I was trying this just for my prototypes as well, and just because like thinking about.
Has he X-rayed it?
He didn't X-ray it, but he did because it's the outer row. He can tell. You know, he shows photos on. It's like a hack.
Oh, okay, because you can see the outer ones. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and so mine is much like his is pretty extreme. Like it really is. It like goes from like circle to pill. Mine is like goes from circle to oval, and so I can just basically a 3 mil space trace could get out, but a 3.5 couldn't. And I was like, well, it makes sense, and in order to be able to like iterate on boards, it makes sense cost wise to be able to do that. And so it was literally a $400 difference in terms of boards to be able to go from blind and buried to this. Slightly modified outer, and that's like the smallest thing. And so I was like, all right, well, it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh no, so. If you can save a huge amount of costs. Oh, once you go to blind buried vias, although it's, you know, it's still reasonable cost these days.
I love doing them. Like I think they are like that is just it makes everything easier. It was an interesting hack, and we'll see how it turns out for mine.
Well, that's this is the art of engineering, right? Especially art of PCB engineering is like lowering your cost. That's one of the arts. And one of the ways you can do that is by changing your design somewhat, your layout somewhat to actually, and or your design, to use a different PCB process and assembly process technology. So you can save cost on the bare PCB and you can save cost on your assembly as well, depending on which parts you choose. Like, for example, simply choosing 0402s for everything, bingo, technically, you're gone up in assembly cost because you've got to use a higher tolerance, assembly machine to do 0402s, especially in high volume and high quantity and you know, things like that, because you'll have potentially a higher failure rate.
Yeah, I'd say it's par for the course though these days. I'd say like maybe moving down into the 0201, 01, 005. Yeah.
Yeah, but technically you can, you know, if you stick to 0805 or 0603s or something, you will have
You can place them yourself.
You've got older, cheaper pick and place machines. Whereas, you know,
it's like a filtering mechanism of like, okay, like you're on like a parametric search and you say, okay, I'm gonna have all 805, everything, the world's your oyster, you can use any machine. But I'm going to use 0402. It's now down to 65% of all the machines. And
yeah, that, 0201, that's right.
30% of the machines, and on and down from there.
And that's assembly. And once again, on bare board, bare PCB cost, you can save cost by, if you don't need that six layer board, if you can get away, you can escape your BGA on four layers, you do it, because it's going to be cheaper. And if you can escape it using, as you said, a higher process, a lower quality process technology like a 4 thou 4 thou instead of 3 thou 3 thou track space, bingo, you've instantly have available cheaper manufacturing process technology. So your bare board should in theory be, well, you could potentially source it cheaper than you did if you, you know, said, oh, I'm going to use 2 thou 2 thou traces because I'm a real designer.
Right. Well, and I think the thing that like popped out to me, so I've done a design with this chip on it before, and it was like 100 mil by 100 mil board, 100 millimeter by 100 millimeter square board, right?
Yep.
And I had to pay for all of that space, but the only chip that needed this was that tiny little one chip. And it's like, so everything else is basically carrying the cost of this one chip. And you could say, well, you could go to a, you know, and really this is why modules are a good idea sometimes too, is that the module, it might have, you know, super tight tolerance, you know, and then it's also pre-certified for FCC. Mm-hmm. There's other reasons to do it, but then you're paying that cost and you're carrying that across other things. And so, I don't know. I think it is a balance point. That is the engineering piece, I suppose.
Oh, yes. If you choose one tiny little pissant BGA, right? Yeah. Like as in tiny, like as in, you know, tiny ball pitch and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And everything else on your design is huge. And you've got a big, you know, 300 millimeter by 300 millimeter board, like a giant board like this, right? That's going to cost a lot of money, right? That's not uncommon. If you're making in industrial stuff, right? Like a giant board's another, you know, a common as mud.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm staring at one right now on my bench.
and then if you choose one component that requires, you know, 3 thou 3 thou traces, bingo, you're screwed, you know.
It's lowest common denominator pretty much.
Yeah. Right? You have to use that process technology for your entire giant board. And that board is going to be $100 a board instead of $5 a board.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's almost like it would make more sense. If you really need that BGA, it would almost make sense to make a plug-in module yourself.
Make a module yourself. Make a little daughter board. Yeah, it's cheaper to get like a tiny little 1-inch by 1-inch board made, put the BGA on there and have pastelated edges or have a, you know, board-to-board interconnect. It'd be cheaper to buy the board-to-board interconnect connectors and put them on your board than it is to pay for a giant board.
High density if you want.
Get, you know, top quality Samtec ones or something, you know. And even if you pay a couple of bucks per connector, it's still cheaper than paying for that one giant $100 bare PCB.
Yep. Yeah, totally. You know,
it's,
totally.
Yeah. It's and you actually see that when I do teardowns of various test instrument scopes and, you know, Keysight scopes you know, other scopes, you see that the high end FPGAs and you know, system on chip processors that they use, right, they always come in like these, you know, high pin count EGA packages, right? So they'll actually put those on the daughter board, and they put them on a daughter board, so then they can transfer the cost of the piece. So it's, they only have to pay for the cost of that small board, that high density small board. They only need that eight layer board for that part of the design. The rest of the scope is just, you know, four or six layers or something.
Right. Well, and just like the RF section too, you could make a small microcontroller go onto Roger's PCB material. But you would be an idiot, you know, like you could do it, but don't do that. That's a bad
don't
idea.
Don't do it. Don't
Your
do
boss
it.
Will get very mad.
Yes.
And so, you do different boards, you do interconnects and everything else. And
Yep.
Can you imagine being like, yes, this is just the finest Roger's material. And there's the Atmega 328P.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
Yeah.
That's the art of PCB engineering. That's the art of, you know. And it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, cost trade-offs.
And I've done many videos on that, I'm sure, over the years. And it's, I'm it's sure. a very important skill.
He doesn't even remember anymore, folks.
He's Come on.
Yeah.
Do you remember every video you've done? I bet you don't.
I do not, no.
No, exactly. Yep.
I did share the link if you wanted to see the what it looks like. I shared the link in our chat program here.
Oh, yes, there it is.
Yeah.
Let's have a look. Let's have a look. Is this public or is this? Oh, no.
It's right. public.
Oh,
yeah, no, it's a Hackaday right. IO post. The, yeah.
Right. Oh, yes. There's a tiny little BGA. Oh, isn't that hideous?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's actually what I wanted to bring up too. So this is actually, so I was shopping I was shopping for power converters the other day. You know, I was at Tashi Station going to get some power converters.
Power converters, yeah. Oh, geez, the solder mask alignment on that BGA is terrible.
Yeah, it's real bad. Yeah, it's really bad. Right, and so like that. Well, that's another good point too. Is like if you're going with a low cost house, you might have other effects that like okay, yeah, sure, oh, yeah. They're going to test your copper and that etched fine, but if the alignment's bad, then you might also be in bad shape of the solder mask rather. So, anyways, I was shopping for DC to DC converters and. It's getting to the point where like I was looking at like the newest fanciest chips and I was like nope, that's BGA is too small and you know and like of course you can filter for all this stuff but you're basically any of the newest chips it's like why wouldn't they do that and then like Tim and Ming had both been talking about in the past two guest episodes like everything's driving towards CSP anyways and so.
CSP is chip scale package for those that don't.
That's right. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And so so upcoming contextual electronics course is actually going to be about doing your first CSP in order to, you know, because like otherwise you start to lock yourself out of certain technologies and certain chips that are everything that's being developed for a cell phone that's going to trickle into the market.
Yeah.
It's all chip scale and it's tiny, you know. It's like
And for those who don't know why it's called chip scale package, just as a side thing, it's because the chip, they're talking about the bare die. So the package is essentially no bigger than the bare die. And that's why they have the BGA, because the bumps on the bottom match up to the, you know, the...
Yeah, usually that's the top level of the metallization. And then, they just literally... Yep.
Actually flip the chip over and then they attach the balls to that and that's the ball, you know, so there's no lead out, like there's no lead frame, it's called in your traditional SO type packages and dip packages and stuff like that, whereas they ultrasonically put in the little bond wires and things like that. There's none of that bond wire rubbish. This is like balls directly on pads on the actual wafer itself, so that's why they're tiny. That's why the pin pitches are tiny. Because the silicon's tiny.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
It's evil.
It's great, man.
No, it's evil.
Invest in your microscopes, you know? Like, oh, I think it's just, no, I, like, honestly, no, it's just, no. It's just the reality of the world we're living in now, you know? Like, and even like, I look at QFNs and I'm like, that's not the size of the silicon in there. You know that there's probably just, it's just a little landing pad with the CSP in there or something like that. Anyways, they're making QFNs, even QFNs, which, you know, a lot of people hate. It's like, they're making that for schlubs like me, you know. They're making, they're not making dip package parts for the out of the goodness of their heart. They're making them because they've been selling them. You know, that's a consistent revenue stream, and you know, some fresh faced engineers, you know, out there making, you know, every time they cost down the silicon, it gets, you know, half as big, and they got to just figure out a new way to hook it up to the dip packages that everybody wants to buy. So, sorry. Isn't this a great industry? Come on.
Oh, can we talk about the automobile manufacturing industry?
Oh, yeah. This is good callback from the beginning. So this is the EV. Dave putting the EV in EEV blog. Here we go.
Yes. And this is great. Munro and Associates, they're like a analysis. I don't even know whether they're an automotive analysis company. They do teardowns of cars, right? That's one of their things.
It's basically like... Yeah, it's like the what's the repair company that does like I tear down. It's like I tear down, but for really big things.
Right. Anyway, their website is leandesign.com. So they're into like, you know, optimizing manufacturing and how things are manufactured and stuff like that. So anyway, they do teardowns of cars. So they get new cars on the market and they tear them down to every last component, every last bolt, and they not only photograph and document all these parts, but they figure out all of the manufacturing cost and the manufacturing yields as well. So they figure out this for every and itemize it for every single part in this car. So they go, okay, this screw here, this module assembly has 20 screws and they cost X amount each, and these moldings, they analyze the injection moldings.
I have a very good example here. Page 319, Dave.
Page 319, obviously. Page 319.
What do you see on there? So
assemble high voltage module cover. What?
Yeah. See what the actual part is, though?
It's a cable harness. Oh, it's a zip tie. It's a zip tie. Yes. They've analyzed this zip tie. This is a great example. Yeah, you're right. So they've analyzed this zip tie and they go, look, they've calculated with a 99.74%, they will get this zip tie right in the assembly process first time.
That's amazing. Right. And it takes 51 seconds to put it on there.
51 seconds to process that and put it on there. And it costs 3 cents. For the material for the cable tie, but the supplier process cost, they've broken this all down, 77 cents for the supplier process cost. That probably includes delivery and everything, you know, the whole thing. Yeah. And the quality burden is they can define all
this
these
is,
things.
This
that's
has
got
to be the most nightmare of a spreadsheet ever. It's probably like you open up the spreadsheet and then 25 minutes later you come back and maybe your computer has stopped choking on it, you know?
Yep. So they've come to the final conclusion. They've added up that it costs $1.02 to install 2 cable ties.
Which is crazy. Right.
So if you can work that part, so if you can, you know, work your, if your mechanical CAD designer can work their magic so that they can integrate the cable tie with that particular plastic molding somehow, you know, like it doesn't need cable ties anymore. It's got some sort of windy thing that you put it in or something, you can save $1 in your for your component cost right there. And this car has like 22,000 parts or something on it. And they analyze every single one of them. And the report we're looking at, right, is 2,627 pages long.
And it's only
for the battery pack in this BMW i3, right? Yeah. This BMW i3 car. Right. Yeah. And there's 10 different PDFs analyzing different subsections of the car. Right.
How much does it cost to take this home today, Dave?
$80,000 to buy this report. But I happen to have paid $10 for it because it's an old report they did in 2015 when the BMW i3 was new. Right. Yep. So they bought one of these cars and they tore it down and it took them probably a year to analyze, 6 months to analyze this thing and produce the reports. Like, how do you produce a report that's 2,000 pages long and do that 10 times? Like,
Anyway, I mean, it's got to be like a forensic style thing, right? Where they're like labeling everything and like putting, you know, logging in the system. And
they must have custom software packages that they put all this information in and the report spits
slow out. To do it, actually get this done.
They can't manually do it. They must have automated processes to do the documentation. So you used to be able to buy this report for $80,000, and obviously they only sold like two dozen reports or something, right? Because you know, sell it to other car manufacturers and sell it to
the suppliers, right? All of the OEMs that are going to here, because if you basically get this, you know, 2 months after, and then you want to start selling like a replacement part. You know, okay, great. Yeah, it's $1 for the zip tie. You better beat that 1 cent price tag, or else you don't even bother, you know?
So anyway, people buy these reports, you know, $80,000. And apparently they spent over $1 million doing this teardown.
Yeah.
You know, to actually produce this actual report. $1 million. Yeah. So hopefully they got the money back. Anyway,
are we gonna have a link for people to buy this or no?
Yes, we will have a link for people to buy this. I'll send it to you. It's great. It's worth the $10 just so that you can see what's involved in manufacturing. If you're interested in anything to do with manufacturing process technology and costing, this will be an eye opener. Really will. Anyway, they decided to release it. They said, "Oh, we've got 10 different reports for this car. We'll charge $1 each. So you can buy all 10 reports for this teardown for this car for $10. And I ponied up the $10 and I've got
the report. I think that's totally worth it. I mean, it's cool.
It is so worth it. I don't even, I couldn't even produce a video on this. It's so, like, as I said, it's 2,600 pages just for the battery.
400 hours of video and Dave is just exhausted at the end. I haven't slept in weeks.
And every part, even down to the cable ties, is photographed, itemized, and cost analyzed. Holy shitballs.
It's great.
This is incredible.
The other thing that's interesting, like just looking at the, so I've only seen the battery stack one that Dave just shared with me, but like even seeing that, like okay, so someone walks up to you on the street and they're like, I need you to design a battery pack tomorrow. I don't know. Where do you start? You know, like what's right. in there? And this is, you know, this is 5 years old, right? So they're already
yep.
however many years down the line and they're working on the newest thing and, you know, increasing capacity, whatever. But okay, this is a great resource for build, you know, say you're building a robot for, you know, a university course or something, and you want to make sure it's really secure. Take some design ideas from here. And it's like, this is a great kind of, these kind of things are great resources just for filling up your mental library of like, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe we could stack vertically instead of horizontally or whatever comes out of it, you know?
Right.
So yeah, it's a required reading. This should be part of college courses.
This is just insane. And then they analyze like the die cast plates and things like that. So you can figure out, you know, look, this die cast, the entire, if you're interested, the entire bottom plate for the whole battery pack, the big aluminum die cast plate, it's massive, right? It costs $62 for the this giant machine. You know, no, it's not die.
Yeah,
know
and they have a material cost, yeah. and they have
material energy. Cost and
something
energy
something forged or stamped or whatever. You know,
yeah,
mechanical stuff.
It's
Dave,
just it's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
I just blown away. You'll be blown away too. See, if you're not blown away by this, get out of the industry because this is bloody interesting stuff. And this is what you know.
We are the arbiters of what's interesting.
Yes, you will exactly. listen to us. Damn right. You will find this interesting or you will leave.
You will look at zip ties and you will think, oh, zip ties, $1.
Oh, man. It's just, yeah, it's mind-blowing stuff. Anyway, definitely worth the $10 or maybe I'll do a video on it and you'll get a snippet of what's in there. But yeah definitely.
Yeah. Cool. I think you should. I think, like I said, just to showcase to people that there's...
Yep.
So are there others out there? Like, how did you find out about this? Did you...
Somebody tweeted it or sent me a somebody sent me an email or something.
Because I would just be interesting if there's like... So like if there was other teardowns like this, you know, like these kind of like crazy teardowns, I think it has to be high dollar materials.
So oh, it's got to be, yeah.
High dollar and high volume, you know, in order to someone spending time on this. But if there was like, you know, say there was like a ventilator teardown like that, you know, then there obviously has been a lot of ventilator stuff. Or, but like, you know... A full
the market's just
of
not
like
big
a,
enough for that. I think you'll only find this in automotive. You wouldn't even find it in aircraft.
Maybe like cell phones, I guess you could kind of do
maybe,
that.
Maybe yes.
But there's so much
cell
hidden
phones,
stuff
probably.
There. This is very mechanical. It seems as well. You know, there's a lot of
and
people do like. So I was watching a teardown video of like an iPhone, like a recent iPhone, and it's like it's interesting, but they're like there's the whole like the. What's it called when it has like the vibration motor in it? They have like a special name for that subsystem. And it's like, they were tearing it down. They're showing it's like, but there's just like blobs of silicon in there. And that, okay. You know, it does some kind of control. There's probably a microcontroller in there. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's not going to tell me as much as like the stack up of like batteries and all the mechanical stuff that's in this one.
Right. So anyway, yes, I know for a fact that there are companies who specialize in forensic teardowns of phones. There are companies that actually do that. And you can buy their reports. They will tear down the latest iPhone and they'll itemize the cost.
I'm looking for the bargain barrel. I want the bargain barrel report prices. I'll pay for it like you did, you know. But
yeah. No, well, you'll get those on like iFixits when they do a teardown. I think they kind of might do a cost estimate of, you know, like the basic chips used in there at least, you know.
Yeah,
but
right.
If you want the real cost, you have to factor in all the assembly and transportation and other warehousing costs, you know, all the costs associated with actually manufacturing, vertically integrating manufacturing an entire phone, you know. Yeah. So
I think the other thing that's interesting about this is like seeing in the mechanical realm too, so much of it is custom. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's obviously, you know, phone manufacturers are moving into their own chip space, right? Apple's doing their own chips and, you know, Samsung does their own chips. And like, that's not out of the realm of possibility, but it's not like they're just, you know, turning around and spinning up a stamping plant they cut a new die to do a new chip. They have to actually go all the way through the process. And in the mechanical realm, it's like there is a lot of custom stuff, especially in the plastics and, you know, like because there's just more tools for doing that sort of thing.
Prepare to have your mind blown. I'm going to give you the executive summary of what it takes to manufacture an electric car battery pack. Here you go. Page 34, Chris, for those playing along.
Dave,
for you.
Let's fire 15% of the workforce. All right, I'm in the right mindset now. I feel like an executive.
Okay.
All right.
Here we go. Just the battery pack in the BMW i3, right? It's the big, you know, a big die-cast, you know, alloy assembly that contains all the cells and, you know, everything else.
Goes on the bottom of the car, low center of gravity. Yep.
Number of parts. Guess, Chris, how many parts are inside?
I'm not looking. I'd say 1,200.
Off by an order of magnitude.
12,000?
12,295 parts.
Oh, wow. Okay. This also, is how we many... got the, or we should say, we got the order of magnitude thing last. Everybody loved to correct us on that one. We got it wrong. Okay, we got it. Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
like, yes, a log the order scale. Of magnitude
it's a log
thing.
Scale.
Although, no, I am, no, yeah, no. I'm still going to stand gonna firm
it.
On that.
I okay, fine, whatever. But a lot of people.
No, I'm standing firm on the log okay, thing. Fine. Five sure. is half an order of magnitude. Damn it. I don't give a shit about the log thing.
Okay.
Nah, fine. Don't care. Don't care. Right,
great.
Nah. In That's the cool. true spirit of order of magnitude, it's an estimation.
I feel, you know, I feel like this is what it is.
Exactly. You know? It's about the feels. Feels over reels, you know?
Feels over reels, yeah. Yeah.
That's anyway, the spirit of order of magnitude. Anyway.
I shouldn't have brought it up.
I'm going to make you guess on each one of those. How many fasteners?
Of the 12,000?
No, how many fasteners, you know, to like cable ties and screws and things? How many?
4,500.
No, now you're way overestimating. 830 fasteners.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know. what else is in a battery pack? I guess like cells and like
things. There are 12,200 parts. How many unique parts?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd say, how much duplication is there? I'd say probably 8,000 uniques. No, 6,500.
500
uniques.
500 so uniques. They... So they're reusing a lot of the same screw, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So then that's a little bit more doable then. So of 500 unique parts, then
500.
Even
it's more doable. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Heck, I've made PCBs with, you know, a couple of hundred unique parts.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. You get into resistor values and all that other stuff.
Yeah. It's, you know. So.
Boy, imagine like all the drawings they have to maintain for all that. Like, talk about PLM. PLM nightmare.
Ugh.
Yuck.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Explain these acronyms.
Product lifecycle management. So that's like you've got screw 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that is now obsolete, or the manufacturer's not making any more. We need to insert screw 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and then you basically rev the drawing, and then it just rolls all the way up the assembly.
Part of engineering.
Yeah. Oh my god.
You definitely want to be one of those engineers. Yeah, who are doing that.
Yeah.
I've spent a week of my life sourcing a screw.
I believe it, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, if you get it wrong, it really, everything goes bad.
Oh, yeah, everything goes tits up, yeah.
That's the real bad, yeah.
Okay, Chris, how many process steps, like how many actual process steps to assemble this entire battery pack?
500.
Order of magnitude again. No, two orders of magnitude.
Wrong direction?
Yeah.
Which way, up or down?
Up.
Really? 50,000 steps?
59,000 steps.
How is that possible? Is it like process step would be like one screw of like a torque wrench is like...
Yeah,
everything. Is like one step?
Yeah.
Oh, so it's like every standard operating procedure is multiplied times however many...
So each, you know, just putting on that cable tie might take 5 steps, you know?
Yeah, right, like, right, okay.
You know, you've got to get the cable tie, then you've
step
got to put
one,
it on, then you've got
yourself.
To cut it off, and then you've
step
you know,
two.
Got...
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, right. No, that's a good point, actually. Like, of the, you zip it down. And insert,
because everything
insert
costs money. When you analyze this, every step costs money. It's time. Time is money. Right?
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, so how
what was the total cost again? What was the total cost of the battery pack?
The total cost is $10,456. It weighs 278 kilos. It takes 33 hours. I won't let you guess anymore. It takes 33 hours. Yeah, supplier process time. So that's the suppliers to manufacture the processors. It takes the original equipment manufacturer processor time is almost 4 hours. Right the first time, they get it right. The
it's
first
percentage
time
of
point,
time they get it right. Yeah, so like error rates and stuff like that, or the opposite.
0.08%. That must be backwards. That sounds backwards.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, because this pops out of the magic formula, right? Because there's 12,000 parts, there's 59,000 steps, you're guaranteed to screw something up.
Oh, so it's like multiplying through basically, like every so if you're like 99% sure that part A is going to work, then that 1% error multiplies through everything else.
Because... multiplies through everything else. And yeah, Jesus. They will, somebody will screw up a step somewhere with 99.9% guarantee. Yeah, Carl. When your pay is being docked 0.1 cents because you wasted X amount of time, you know.
Oh my God. This is like that's like a good, you know, like manufacturing sucks is like, that's a good... I mean, that's why, like, you talk about it's like Six Sigma, though. It's like you have to drive everything towards that Six Sigma point order to get everything to have a yield of 80% or 90%.
Right, exactly. After your 1,000 steps, yeah. Right.
Yeah, what's crazy about this is I keep thinking, like, oh, yeah, this is like BMW saying this. This is a third-party company saying this. So this is all conjecture still. Like, they could be totally wrong, but it sure sounds right.
it's based on their experience, right? This is what this company, these are experts. This is what they do.
Yeah, they're probably hiring old manufacturing engineers and people that worked at BMW anyways, right?
Yep. It's like, right. And anyway, so at $10,456 manufacturing cost, only $4,900 of that is the actual material cost. The rest of it is OEM process cost, supplier process cost, $107 for quality burden.
Yeah, you got to check those parts.
Yeah,
someone's looking at it. Stuff like you somebody's pay their looking salary. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's $100 just in the cost. And SG&A, I don't know what SG&A is, but that's $1,500.
That's another overhead amount. I forget what it is.
I can tell you.
An accountant would know what that is.
Yep.
But it's like the carrying cost of the organization, I'm pretty sure.
Right. Yep.
Selling, general, and administrative expenses, right? So basically,
there we go. Yep.
Yeah, all the overhead of sales.
All the paperwork overhead. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And all the other overhead. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you have to pay managers and you have to pay, you know.
Sure. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. That meeting does actually cost money, as much as your manager doesn't really pay attention to that.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so that is absolutely fascinating. So well worth your $10 if you're, you know.
What are the other reports? So this is just the battery pack, does it do like the motor, assembly and stuff like that too?
The other one, yes, the drive line is a report. The Rex system, whatever the hell the Rex system, the IP and interior trim, the seats have their own report.
Infotainment system. That's probably the IP, yeah.
Yep. Oh, yes. Yeah. IP info something. Yeah. Structure of the body, the exterior report. So like bumpers and things like, you know, headlights and things like that. The rolling chassis report, the system electronics report. So they've got a report for the system electronics.
Probably
so,
you know, all your. Just for the harness, probably like the cabling harnesses.
Yeah. And your car computer and your anti-lock braking ECUs, computer radar.
Yeah, that
sensors
would be a good one to look at too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 It would be. And then the cooling system has its own report. So, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. the battery has to be cooled and everything, you know, and the aircon. It'd include the aircon system. And yeah, so there's 10 separate reports and you can get it for $10.
They're going to sell a couple of reports, I think, after this, Dave.
Yeah.
You should get some kind of referral.
I should get a kickback. I should get a referral. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Anyway, it's just, yep. And they've got right at the end, if you look at the second last page or something, they have some YouTube videos for the BMW i3 plant assembly line videos. So I have not watched those yet, but that could be fascinating as well. So,
yep.
But the cost, wow.
There was a disappointing video. I thought it was going to be better. It was an Intel factory tour. It was just showing like the internals.
I saw that. It's nice. It's nice to see the pods go. And they just showed these pods, these overhead the
Foops,
pods.
They're called, Dave.
Foops. Oh, sorry, I didn't
front
use the
opening unified pod.
it's worth
this
a watch.
My experience talking. Yeah, yeah. I wish there was more stuff like that because it really is interesting. It gets kind of dull after working,
but you've got to have somebody knowledgeable on the whole thing to take you on a proper technical guided tour. You know,
like a start to finish.
This is just a fluff piece. You know, look at all our fancy overhead robots.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
kind
yeah.
of yeah.
And the robot systems are really interesting and like you know how they have like well I guess what like, yeah. we talked about earlier right thinking about like supply chain like you can visualize supply chain in a fab right so like if you. And they don't show that. Well, they show a little bit of this, but basically, like you think about, if you've got a photolithography process where they're, you know, basically they're exposing a wafer and then they rinse it, and then it's supposed to go to dry etch, which is my thing that I used to do. And then, but say I messed something up and I broke all the machines, I never did that. Let's just pretend I never did that.
Right. Yeah.
But then basically what happens is you have all of this, you know, all of this supply coming in there and just like building up. And like, so literally they have like these storage bins, like these storage areas inside a fab where they will just store the foops for however long. And eventually they'll have to slow down the incoming stuff. But say now you slow down the incoming stuff and you just turn off all of photolithography. Then you just say, nope, nothing else is coming through. And then finally Chris gets his shit together and that process step starts to go again. And then you work through the backlog. And then, but then if you don't start up the photolithography stuff again, then there's not enough supply in that cycle, in that chain rather. And now you're running behind again. And so it's like this push pull. And so it's like a really good visualization of like, of the overall electronics supply chain of, you know, if you don't have the parts in your start at the right time,
yeah,
it just ripples all the way through and it really can,
and it screws you know,
and,
it, yeah.
And it's like, yeah. And now Steve Sanghi's begging us to, you know, put us 12 week, whatever. And that's because like, they're just trying to make sure that they don't look like, you know, buttheads because they don't have any parts. Right. And so that's ultimately what it's coming down to.
Yeah. Because they have to plan them. They've got to buy the raw materials. They've got to set up the process line.
Yeah. It's a crap job. I don't envy them. We just get to sit here and complain. This is the thing to be doing.
And we just watch videos here. Going, ooh, robots. I was actually surprised at the complexity of this overhead robot system, which basically just transports wafers like through like 12 different buildings. It's like,
Know, how would you do it differently? Cause I
don't know. I just thought they'd be on carts and they'd just wheel them around. Like I didn't think there was that high volume in terms of like as one wafer, you can get like thousands of chips out of. Right. Yeah. So I didn't think there was that kind of throughput in terms of wafers kind of thing. I was just actually surprised that they needed to go to this sort of effort. To physically transport the wafers around.
Yeah, there's like a there's basically like a monorail for these.
Yeah,
hoops,
it's a monorail.
Like the robots, and then basically the monorail comes up. It lowers it literally, like Dave's saying, with cables, and then it lowers it onto a like a platform, and then the whole foop slides in to actually get processed by the particular process step it's at. And yeah, it's I think if it was on the floor, you wouldn't get as much. So first off, you couldn't have humans there, and then you just wouldn't get as much throughput either, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And they've got storage bays, like when they're not being, you know, when they're waiting for the next process step, the robots can just pick these up and go put them in the storage facility, and they're all tracked and marked, and then they can bring them back out once the next step is up and running, you know, or is actually. They go, right, we have to manufacture more, you know, Intel i7s over here. You know, and push the button and the floop comes in with your wafers, you know, there to go or whatever. Yeah.
The floop, yep.
Whatever it is, I don't know. What's it called?
Foop, F-O-U-P.
Yeah, foop. Foop.
Yeah. Foop's a good word, though. I mean, I like it. I just think it's, you know.
Anyway, that's enough about manufacturing. Jeez, this whole episode was about manufacturing, wasn't it? We have no idea what we're going to talk about when we start this show. We just press record and it goes somewhere, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just anyway. So we're way over time. So let's end with. Unfortunately, we have to end on sad news, but we really have to. Yeah.
Yeah, we got to mention it.
Grant Imahara from he was one of the MythBusters. Yeah, sadly passed away at 49. He wasn't old. In fact, he didn't. You know, he looked nowhere near 49.
Yeah, yeah. He was always boyish looking. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he had a brain aneurysm, and he's apparently quite sudden. Although not that sudden. Apparently, I read a thing that it didn't just suddenly happen. It happened over like 2 or 3 days or something. So it happened over a couple of days. Like he was just having dinner and
complications from that kind of
and
thing.
And they tried to save him, but over a couple of days, he had two operations. They were actually, he was preparing to go into a third operation, but the brain aneurysm just got him. Unfortunately, Grant Imahara, a true nerd, a true engineering nerd like us. And, I only heard good things. Like everyone I know who actually knew him said he was a top bloke. So,
yep, definitely. Yep. Yeah, I got to really meet him a couple times, but it was always like promotion, engineer. You know, type things. Right. Like,
Yep.
So, yeah, we're going to miss him. It's it's, you know, people should go check out. Obviously, there's all the old Mythbusters things to watch, but also the, you know, the
I haven't watched the Battle White and, Rabbit Project, and there's the BattleBots and yeah. And he starred on a Star Trek series.
Yeah, I didn't
well.
Know that. Actually, he was
Sulu. No,
yeah.
I didn't know that either. He was he yeah. played Sulu on a.
I think that was like a. It wasn't fan fiction, but it was like a fan.
It's yeah.
Kind
it's
of thing.
More yeah. It's something yeah. like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a web series type of thing.
Yep.
So it's cool.
So yeah, very sad for a fellow nerd, fellow engineer.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and if people want to hear other nice anecdotes about him, Adam Savage, who worked with him on Mythbusters, obviously.
Yes, I've
him
watched
and Norm
that.
Chan yep. over on Tested, they did like a.
Yep, there's some great stories.
Like 1 hour kind of yeah.
Yep.
What we're calling yep. it. So yeah, that was really
fantastic.
That was a nice tribute. So
yeah, it's a. Geez, I hate 2020.
Yeah, it friggin' sucks.
Sucks, man. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Really does. But yeah, that's unfortunately, that's a, you know, a bit of a wake up call. It's like, geez, you know, he was only young and, yep, that, you know, no other pre existing medical conditions that I was aware of. And just, mm-hmm. yep. Brain aneurysm. Geez. Yeah. Fingers crossed. Touch wood.
Fingers crossed that you, yeah, okay.
That I don't, yeah, don't, you know, something doesn't Got explode it. Inside me, you know.
Got it, yep,
yep. Yep. So, yeah, sad loss, unfortunately, for the industry. He was one of, like, the high-profile engineers. You know, there's only, you know, there's not too many high-profile engineers in the industry.
I agree,
and
yeah.
And he was one of them. Like, could you name what other high-profile engineers, like, public engineer, you know, there'd be Bill Nye, the science guy, who's technically a mechanical engineer. He's not a
yeah,
scientist.
Maybe like Dean Kamen, maybe.
Yeah, but no, people don't know him as an engineer, I guess. Like, people know that, yeah, Grant Imahara, yeah, he's the engineer from Mythbusters, you know?
Yeah.
He was
yeah,
like,
true.
You know, I mean, there's not too many. Please leave it in the comments down below if you're aware of any other, like, you know, public. Yeah, obviously we could rattle off names in our little niche, of
yeah,
course,
right.
but that. You know,
yeah, you stop
count.
Someone on the street, though. That's the real question.
You stop someone on the street and they're not going to know who Bob
they'd be like,
is, right?
They'd be
you know,
like, what's an engineer? That's what probably
yeah,
most
yeah,
of them
right.
would say. But
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yep. I think Grant was a great example of outreach and, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, like, I read tons of people in comment sections just saying that Grant got him in engineering, and that is a hell of a legacy. So.
Yep, yeah. It is. And he did all those Mouser videos, which were more mainstream kind of thing. They were like, you know, he went around to, you know, and visit different places and things like that, and sort of did, you know, more general interest engineering stuff.
Well, we should all aspire to do that. I think everyone should go build a robot in Grant's honor.
Or simply design a PCB, because he was an...
Sure, yeah, why not
he
that
was
too?
A
yeah.
fellow nerd like us. That's what he did, yeah. You know, so... Any engineering will do. We'll take any engineering. It doesn't have to be robots.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Catch you next time.